Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome on behalf of JBD to our debate, our second debate. Jeff Block now lines up against Johnny, and our first one is he's working his way through the Baker family. I don't know who's next. We get Yossel next.
He's healed.
If you might have checked your diaries, you'll notice that today is the 29th of November. On the 29th of November 1947, the UN General Assembly voted in favour of, what's it called, General Assembly Resolution 181, which is the partition plan. And if you've been to Israel, you notice that there are streets named Khaftet B'November. I don't know if any other country in the world names streets after dates, but they do in Israel. So we're going to... they do? Other countries do? So first of all, thank you to Cornwalls for hosting and sponsoring today's event. Thank you for everyone for showing up on a busy day. Good to see a few Mo's for here for another couple of days. Thank you to our debaters. The format's going to go like this. Jeff is going to go first, even though he's the negative, and he's going to speak for about 10 to 12 minutes. Then Johnny's going to speak for as long as he speaks, and then we'll open it up for questions. No. Then we'll open it up for questions and discussions, which I'll moderate, and we'll finish up with Mincha at 1:45. Jeff Block needs no introduction, but I'll introduce him anyway. He's a barrister practicing in contract and commercial law, a member of Lawyers Without Borders, a member of Balcor of Mizrahi Shul. He's a greenie, which means that 5 days a year he goes camping and fly fishing. Jeff, thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, the debate topic, the relevance of the 67 borders to the peace process, is really fictitious. It's a fictitious debate because it contains an obviously invalid assumption. It assumes that there is a genuine bilateral peace process between Israel and the Palestinians. In my view, it's doubtful that there ever was. I think Yasser Arafat, Yamach Shema, probably saw us coming from miles away and took us for the desperate peacemakers we are. But even if once upon a time there was a genuine peace process, the evidence to the contrary is so overwhelming that I really can't take seriously anyone who seriously pretends that there is one now. We watched in revulsion throughout the 90s and the first half of this decade as every unilateral concession by Israel, every offer by Israel, whether under the various incarnations of Oslo or under one of the other peace initiatives such as Camp David or Wye River or the roadmap, was met with truly sickening Palestinian terrorist brutality, encouraged by the PA, celebrated in the Palestinian street, and apologised for by many on the left, including, I regret to say, the Jewish left. The recent images of Mahmoud Abbas that we've all seen, where he embraces serial murderers as heroes in the wake of the Shalit transaction, betray the PA's true agenda. Since Oslo, which was the accord that established the PA, the established pattern has been that the PA pockets Israeli concessions but makes none itself. In the wake of the recent International Atomic Energy Agency report confirming what we all already knew, that Iran is indeed well advanced in its nuclear weapons program, why do we continue to delude ourselves that there is a genuine bilateral peace process when our enemies believe that the elimination of Israel is almost within their grasp? We also should remember that the two core promises on the PA side of Oslo 1 were never kept. The PLO covenant, not to mention the Hamas Charter, calls for the elimination of Israel. That's still the case. Nothing has been done to cease incitement to hatred and renouncing terrorism. Over the past 20 years, nothing has been done to promote peaceful coexistence with Israel. To the contrary, the PA has stolen the innocence of successive generations of Palestinian youth by teaching them that their highest value must be shahada, martyrdom, which we all know is a euphemism for murdering innocent Jews. The PA should have been teaching them that their martyrs are despicable murderers who bring shame rather than honour on Palestinian society. Education is everything. Without it, this is all a charade. and those who mindlessly call for further unilateral concessions by Israel, such as withdrawing from the West Bank to the pre-67 borders, place more importance on gratifying their own misguided social consciences than on Israel's security. There is no genuine peace process. Well, having said that, let's now pretend, for the sake of preserving this fictitious debate, that there is a genuine peace process. So that calls for us then to focus on the phrase, are the 67 borders relevant? And I'll list a few reasons why the 67 borders ought to be of little or no relevance as a starting point in peace negotiations, let alone as a basis for any settlement. So first and foremost, logic. There is no kedusha to the 67 lines, which are otherwise known as the Green Line. They are not sacrosanct. The Green Line was not the border voted on by the UN in the partition plan of 29th November 47. It was simply the armistice line at the end of hostilities in the War of Independence after five Arab armies attacked Israel at her birth. Once that armistice line was violated and eliminated, as it was at the outbreak of the Six-Day War, the new armistice line at the cessation of those hostilities became the Jordan Valley and in Gaza the Mediterranean Sea. Now, at that moment, the old 1949, because the War of Independence actually spilled over into 49, the old 49 armistice line lost all relevance, or perhaps more accurately, ought to have lost all relevance. It logically follows that the new armistice line, not the old one, should be the starting point in any peace negotiation. To negotiate on the basis of an arbitrary, irrelevant, non-existent border is obtuse and illogical and amounts to a 100% territorial concession by Israel even before negotiations get underway. That is the brilliance of the Palestinians' bargaining position. Even the supposedly more moderate position of a retreat to the 67 borders but with appropriate land swaps to enable Israel to retain the main settlement blocks, that's a problematic way forward. A number of real problems with the concept of land swaps, not least of which is that it assumes that the 67 borders are indeed sacrosanct. So that's reason number one. Reason number two as to why the 67 borders are irrelevant, it's important to help avoid future conflict. Israel's enemies must understand that unprovoked aggression comes at a cost. The Six-Day War was started by Egypt blockading the Straits of Tiran to Israeli shipping, which is a clear act of war, coupled with Nasser's bellicose boast that Egypt and neighbouring Arab armies in alliance would drive the Jews into the sea. Defeated provocateurs have no legal, moral, or God-given right to have captured territory handed back on a silver platter without penalty. Jordan, therefore, wasn't entitled to a return of the West Bank, and there was no PA representing the Palestinians' interests in any event. For the same reason, Syria wasn't and isn't entitled to the return of the Golan Heights. Just to hand back captured territory is counterproductive because it telegraphs to our enemies that no price will be paid for a failed attack. This, of course, encourages further attacks at a time of their choosing. Negotiating a return to the 67 borders would therefore provide an excellent incentive for further Palestinian intransigence and hostility. Reason number three, security. We would be inviting a repetition of the disastrous Gaza experience in August 2005. A retreat to the 67 border is exactly what Israel did in the Hitnat Kut. There was no nation building by the PA. Israel's magnanimity in withdrawing to the 67 border was rewarded by the creation of a terrorist state on its southern doorstep. 6,000 unprovoked rocket attacks on Israeli civilian population centres and an unchecked arms build-up. Johnny and I actually debated the Hitnat Kut at Beit Weizmann in August 2005, just before it occurred, and I predicted exactly what would happen. It was quite obvious, I hasten to add, it's quite obvious to anyone careful not to be led astray by emotion or wishful thinking, and we now know with absolute certainty what a premature peace looks like, and it's not a pretty sight. The idea that Israel should transplant Gaza to her heartland is inane. There is no way Israel will tolerate the same thing happening there. when we've already been down that path once, that disastrous path, why on earth would we voluntarily march over the cliff again like lemmings? And can I say parenthetically that had the Hitnut Kut led to nation building, which by the way is what Johnny said would happen, they could have demonstrated their intention to live in peace with Israel, and by now almost certainly the Palestinians would be well on their way to establishing autonomy in most of the West Bank. But it didn't happen. We're up to reason number four, practical reasons. It is simply no longer practicably possible for Israel to withdraw to the 67 borders because of the huge number of settlers on the West Bank. I don't know if you know this, but over the Green Line there are over 750,000 Israelis living in 121 officially sanctioned settlements and another 30 or so unofficial settlements. All debate for or against settlements is now moot. We can wring our hands, we can fret all we wish. The settlers have won by default. If Israel could not satisfactorily evict and rehabilitate 8,000 Israelis from Gaza, and that remains an ethical stain on Israeli society, she cannot seriously consider evacuating and rehabilitating many hundreds of thousands. A scale, if one includes all 750,000, that's a scale 95 times the size of Gaza. My arithmetic serves me correctly. Final reason why there's no relevance to the 67 borders in any settlement negotiation is the Palestinians themselves. And that's because there's almost certainly no genuine intention on the Palestinian side ever to live in peace side by side with Israel. At least Hamas makes no secret of it. As to the PA, well, I can give two recent examples. You can give a myriad of examples, but I'll settle for the two that are the most recent. Mahmoud Abbas is on the record in September as saying that Palestinians have been occupied for 63 years. Not 44, 63, you do the math. He's talking about occupation since the State of Israel was established. He is a refugee from Tzfat, so to my ear, it seems that he considers Tzfat and Tel Aviv settlements in much the same way as you might consider Efrat or Ariel to be settlements. Second example I can give, again in September, the Palestinian envoy to the UN, Ma'in Rashid Erekat, stated that the PLO position opposed the immediate presence of Jews and gays in an independent Palestinian state, and that Jewish and Arab populations must be totally separated. Well, these sentiments are not consonant with any genuine long-term intention to live in peace alongside Israel. Rather, these statements raise the depressing inevitability of hostile and resentful neighbours doomed to never-ending conflict. Well, is there a way forward? I actually believe there may be, but debating alternate peace initiatives is beyond the ambit of this debate. Perhaps it could be addressed in question time if there's time. It probably deserves the topic in itself, David. The bottom line is that with regard to the conventional two-state paradigm, negotiating a retreat to the 67 borders makes perfect sense if you're a Palestinian. It makes absolutely no sense whatsoever if you are an Israeli. Any process based upon a retreat to the 67 borders is out of the question. Israel knows it. I suspect most world leaders know it. And even Abbas and his cronies know it. But let's all just keep pretending and rabbiting on about it endlessly, because the policy of containment is perhaps the best outcome in all the circumstances. If there ever is to be a meaningful peace negotiation, then let the PA first start educating Palestinian youth to peaceful coexistence with Israel. That is the starting point to any serious negotiation. But don't hold your breath. If and when it happens, I'll then gladly jump across to Johnny's side of the debate and probably embrace many of the arguments you'll now hear.
Thanks very much, Jeff. Johnny Baker is a graduate of Hebrew University, past president of State Zionist Council, or is it now known as Zionist Council of Victoria, I think. Current president of an organisation called Amenu Australia, which is a roof body for what he calls moderate Zionism, whatever that is. Maybe you can tell us. Anyway, over to Johnny. Thank you.
Sorry, I've got to find a document. I thought the introduction would be equally sort of gratifying and lengthy, but ending up whatever that is, moderate Zionism, sort of puts me a bit on the spot. Bear with me while I just go through and find what I need to do. Should be there. Okay. Geoffrey, thanks. You gave me a peg to hang my kippah on, which is why I haven't got it on at the moment. And that is, I'll begin from the beginning, or the end of what you say, because I think it's the most relevant thing, because you end up saying that at the end of the day, the idea of a Palestinian state makes absolute sense to Palestinians only and absolutely no sense to Israelis. And I always suspected that this debate, notwithstanding the title you chose about the relevance of the 67 borders, was not really going to be what you were coming here to debate, but rather to argue that the very notion of a Palestinian state is not in Israel's interests and is unachievable and is a non-starter and is only in the interest of the Palestinian side. And really, what I'm here to say is fundamentally the opposite. That is, I'm not that interested in the Palestinian perspective on things. It's not for me to get into their heads. It's not for me necessarily to understand what motivates and drives them. Primarily, my argument for the issue of a two-state solution derives from what I would consider to be a Jewish and Israeli imperative, and one that is critical if the state of Israel is to remain what I aspire for it to be and so many Israelis, namely a democratic and Jewish state based on ethical values and actions. And it's my argument, again, for the moment, putting aside the practicalities that you've raised, Geoffrey, and we can get to the 67 borders a little later, that a Palestinian state, a two-state solution, is an absolute imperative for all of those elements that some of us treasure about Zionism, and I'll call us, some of us, moderate Zionists, so you do understand what I mean it was about. It's about an organisation that has a vision of there being a form of moderate Zionism, a Jewish state that is democratic, that's ethical, that's thoroughly Jewish, that doesn't unnecessarily oppress another people, which leads to the corruption of its very moral fibre, as anyone who has a look at what's going on at the moment can recognise about it. I'm concerned primarily about the Jewish people. I'm concerned about the very nature of the state of Israel, and that is why I advocate so strongly, putting aside for the moment the practicalities, the borders, the negotiating issues, first of all, our difference is a fundamental one, because for Geoffrey, it would seem that somehow the status quo is an acceptable, if not a desirable, situation. Those of you who have read his pieces in Gullus Australis will have read some of his fanciful solutions. I presume he might raise them again in question time. But at the end of the day, what they are is fundamentally racist outcomes and something that I absolutely reject totally. So let's look for a moment at the situation as it continues in the absence of a two-state solution, because I think that's the critical component we need to consider. I'm just regurgitating the fundamental stuff that some of you might think comes from the left, but eventually, with the status quo, the Arabs inside Israel combined with or together with the Palestinians on the West Bank will eventually constitute a majority, or pretty close to a majority, of the population that occupies the greater part of any area to the west of the Jordan. And that means that Israel will have to make a decision as to whether or not it's going to continue to hold these people as second-class citizens, to oppress them, to have them under their tutelage, or to give them free representation and equal rights, which I think is a fundamental given if you're coming from things from a liberal, democratic perspective. In the absence of that, Israel will become, and I hate to use the word because I don't believe that it's legitimate at the present time, but Israel, if it actively chooses to not accord equal rights to a sizable minority, if not a majority, of people living in the area that it controls, will become a state that can be defined as nothing other than an apartheid state. And that's something that I, who have always had a certain vision of Israel, recoil from and would never want to see occur. The other alternative, of course, is that Israelis take a punt and say that notwithstanding the close to absolute majority that other peoples other than the Jewish people have living within that particular area, somehow we can maintain our fundamental essence of being a Jewish state. Now, I, for one, treasure the notion of a Jewish state, a state that's driven by Jewish ideals, that has Jewish symbols, that beats to the rhythm of a Jewish drum. And I think that that should be preserved at all costs. Therefore, the idea of not having a Jewish state on the one hand or not having a democratic state on the other hand simply does not sit comfortably with me. I don't see any fundamental ideological, in principle, possibility any other way unless, and this is a legitimate way of seeing things, the only out to breaking this conundrum, to breaking this fundamental inconsistency in principle, is if one has a messianic vision of things. In other words, if one believes that notwithstanding all the objective trends and facts and issues on the ground, that somehow there'll be a circuit point, and that circuit point is the eventual coming of the Mashiach. And by the way, let's be very frank about it. A lot of this debate, and I think I agree with you, Jeffrey, to a certain extent, the settlers have won lock, barrel and dice, and the reason for that is that they are driven by a messianic impulse. I mean, I can look around the crowd here and see that most of you understand full well what I mean by that and have probably studied the readings and learnings of settler rabbis and of Rabbi Cook's followers and so on and so forth. So if you're a messianist, you've got a way out. And by the way, if you come from a Chabad perspective, which has a different messianic outlook on the world, you've also got a way out, because there have been certain directives given from those above in the Chabad movement that have also determined, halachically, that it's impermissible to return any territory. And there are those on the, what I would call, almost secular right, who also have a quasi-secular messianic vision of things, that somehow believe that this situation continue ad infinitum and will be eventually resolved. I have to confess in front of you that if it does come to any messianic impulse in my own being, I tend to agree to the more Litvisha side of things. In fact, to the non-Zionist, if not anti-Zionist, perception of what the state of Israel means in messianic terms, and that is, if you believe in the Mashiach, believe in the Mashiach, and the Mashiach will come when the Mashiach comes, lo litchok et haketz. We will, as people, not be able to bring forward the messianic era, and we need to live our lives in the face of given realities and circumstances. Now, I think it's interesting that Jeffrey, in describing all the conflict, did not mention on any single occasion anything other than Jews and Palestinians, Abbas and Arafat. He said the word Yimach Shmo, I won't disagree with that, and a few Jewish leaders. He didn't mention the international community. He didn't mention the United States of America. He didn't mention the European Union. He didn't mention the Arab world. It just so happens that Israel operates and needs to operate in a bigger world out there. And even if there were a consensus in Israel, and there is not, by the way, Jeffrey, let me stress that whatever you say about it at the moment, all opinion polls, both on the Israeli side and the Palestinian side, at least to date, are suggesting that in the correct circumstances, both parties would be willing to create a two-state solution based more or less on a readjustment of the 67 borders. So there's a much broader reality in which Israel has to operate, and I find it peculiar that in his presentation, Jeffrey's entirely neglected any mention, any discussion of the fact that Israel, if you're not messianic, has to operate in a given concrete reality. So not only does the entire world, the entire democratic world, all those who are friendly to Israel, Australia included, by the way, on both sides, and Israel's stated policy and the majority of Israelis and Palestinians point towards a two-state solution, but everything works towards that direction. Now, as for the topic of the debate, are the 67 borders sacrosanct? No, there's no kedusha in them. Of course they're arbitrary. But things happen. And the reality is that we need to operate in a situation that currently exists. And what currently exists, for better or for worse, is that there was a war in 1948, and let's not be overly one-sided about the rights and wrongs of the situation. Let's not pretend that all the blame belongs with the Palestinian side of things. I too can selectively quote Abbas, and he appeared only 2 weeks ago on Channel 10 in Israel and spoke directly to the Israeli people and pointed out that whilst Olmert was in power, he and Olmert were, and he used this terminology, this close to achieving a resolution of things. Now, of course, that could be a retrospective thing to point the finger at Netanyahu, who, by the way, at least publicly, has been in support of a two-state solution both before the entire world and the United Nations. So it's just almost fanciful to live outside a reality and to conjure up some sort of in principle outer world without looking at the practicality of things the way they are. I guess I could go on and on, but what I want to do is leave some things for question times. But the thrust of my argument is A, that from a Jewish perspective, from an Israeli perspective, from an ethical perspective, from a demographic perspective, unless one is a fundamental messianist, a two-state solution is desirable. Two, I don't think it's entirely in the Palestinians' favour to achieve a two-state solution. I'd say the opposite. The clock is running against Israel's direction. As time goes on, more and more Palestinians are rejecting, you might call it lip service, but frankly I don't care where they're coming from, because I think Israel is strong enough to enforce what ultimately emerges. The reality is that the more, as time proceeds and time progresses, more of the Palestinian world, more of the international community, particularly coming out of Europe, are going to drop the two-state solution idea, and they're going to call for a one-state solution. And that one-state solution will ultimately subsume what is so precious to us, namely a democratic, active Jewish state, and that is something I am terrified about. It was Abba Eben who said that the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity, and there are others, like myself, who believe that in more recent times, in fact, so too has the Israeli leadership never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity. It's a sad, but unfortunate reality. I remember when you and I were students at university, Jeffrey, the idea of even talking about a Palestinian people was taboo. Now it's the mainstream. It was certainly taboo to mention giving back territory. Now it's a common idea and it's been carried out in Israel. It was certainly taboo to talk about a Palestinian state, and now it's official Israeli policy supported by the majority of the Arab people. I'm telling you here and now that as much as there are those who want to talk about two states being unrealizable, unachievable, an anathema to the state of Israel, if it is not achieved in the medium term, there will be a time when we turn around and kick ourselves for not having achieved something which we will have chapt mit beide hent, as I would say today, if it's not done in our own time. Now, as for the practicalities of it, you use the word security. I'm not a security expert, neither are you, I suggest. But there's a significant portion of the Israeli military, in fact you would recognise most chief of staffs, most former Mossad heads, most of the political leadership, that somehow have a different view than you and I do, and I'm more than happy to defer to them. I'm not suggesting for one minute that the Israeli army should be weak. I think when Israel needs to take risks, it needs to be essentially strong. And I'm also not one of those who believes that Israel shouldn't enforce their strength when needed. So yes, it's true, Jeffrey, that you and I debated on Gaza. What you impute to me about having said, and as though the reality you suggested was the only one that has emerged, is not entirely correct, because you might recall that I did say that should the Palestinians step out of hand after then, Israel should bomb the hell out of them, which is precisely what it did. And I personally was not opposed to that give or take part of what occurred. But fundamentally, when Israel has to exercise its strength, so it should, because that's the only way it'll be able to achieve peace. As for Gaza, since you've mentioned it, the reason Gaza didn't succeed, as one would have hoped it would, is precisely because there was not a negotiated settlement, precisely because it was unilateral, precisely because Israel, in its view of Palestinians, simply felt, you do what you want with it, we're going to dump it. And also because in part at the time, I think Sharon, although there are others who disagree with me here, was giving back Gaza in order to preserve the West Bank, although I've heard theorists in recent times to say that he understood full well that a Palestinian state will have to emerge on the West Bank also. As he would say, Dvarim Shiro Imikan, Lora Imishan. What you see from here as Prime Minister is not exactly what I saw when I was doing other things, which is why Sharon, of all hardliners, had a very fundamental turn when he understood the nature of responsibility, of dealing with the international community that you neglect so totally, of looking at the alternatives, as so did Olmert, as so did Tzipi Livni and so many other people from the Likud, who moved across to parties and, as they had a reality hit, as we should be here today, understood that, like it or not, history or not, Kedusha or not, a Palestinian state is simply an imperative, I won't say a Palestinian state, a two-state solution, which not only creates a Palestinian state, but frees Jews from the occupation and allows them to concentrate on the fundamental, vital enterprise of Zionism, which is having a Jewish state which is democratic, free, united, able to concentrate on the things that are so beautiful about our tradition, rather than, and I'm not being critical of individuals, but you know, you can knock every newspaper in the world, but The Australian, which is supposedly the one newspaper in the world that stands out so supportive of Israel, printed an article last week, and I don't think it was just by mistake, that showed and demonstrated, whether it was exaggerated or not, that occupation by its very nature destroys the soul of a nation. And it's happening to Israel as an internal cancer. Were we right in 67? Sure we were. But if we think and take the attitude of they tried to attack us, we defeated them, they must be punished, then the only people we'll be punishing are ourselves. And so in concluding, because I can see I've gone over my time, I'm putting forward that a two-state solution is a necessity. And going back to the topic of the debate, which we really didn't discuss, if there is to be such a two-state solution, then although it must not be identical to the 67 borders, because sure, the large settlement blocks will have to be part of a Jewish state, and they will absorb most of the settlers, but so too there will have to be land swaps, there will have to be sacrifices, there will have to be difficulties. The alternative, I'm afraid, is too horrific and fundamental to contemplate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Johnny. I think the presentations from the two speakers just highlight the difficulty in simply framing debate, let alone having debate. Probably, there, given the topic, there's 10 different ideas about what this would have been about, and none of them ended up being what it was about. Now, Jeff has asked to specifically rebut some points that Johnny made, so he'll do that for a few minutes, and then we'll open it up for questions.
That's okay. I actually thought that I was faithful to the debate. The debate topic is quite clear. The 67 borders relevant to the peace process, and I addressed that fairly and squarely. I'm mystified about two things. First of all, how Johnny could have understood the debate topic to be whether there should or shouldn't be a two-state solution. The other thing I'm mystified about, if he's read anything that I've written, is how he could possibly characterise me as being someone who advocates, who's a messianist, and advocates against a two-state solution. Just to prove my leftist credentials in this sphere, I should point out that in 1990, and you can go back in the archives of the AJ, and Johnny will know this because he and Mark, I think, complimented me at the time. I wrote an article in 1990 in the AJN about Israel withdrawing from Gaza unilaterally, and people laughed at it, saying that it's so out of left field it would never happen. And what I advocated there was a complete unilateral withdrawal from Gaza and a unilateral withdrawal from a large part of the West Bank so as to create the opportunity for Palestinians to realise their national aspirations. So I do take some umbrage at the suggestion that I'm some messianist, and that this debate was all about whether there should be a two-state solution or not. The other points I've got is it is deserving of comment. There is a significant degree of autonomy already on the West Bank. This is something most people overlook. Occupation, it is indeed a military occupation, but it's not a civic occupation. The Palestinians don't pay taxes to us. They have their own civic responsibilities. I think that's something that should be borne in mind. We are really talking, when we talk in terms of an occupation, it is a military occupation. And either it is workable or it isn't workable. At the moment, it really isn't workable for all the reasons I outlined.
We'll open up for questions now. Michael, you're so quick. Should be on sale of the century.
It's my job in life. Ask questions. What are you asking, Jeffrey?
Yeah, you can direct your question to either or both.
I'd like to ask the gentleman on my left the paper, a question, Johnny.
Yes.
First of all, while I agree, I'm personally for a two-state solution. What I have a problem with is land for peace. I mean, we've seen it in the region. They're already breaking some of their covenants or some of their agreements with what's happened with the embassy attacks in Cairo, the gas pipes continuing to be blown up, and some of the military that shouldn't be in the Sinai are there. What I'm worried about is you want to give you want to swap some sort of territory for a piece of paper from the Palestinians, basically, that says we'll make peace. And that I have a problem with, because we know we can't trust them. The history shows us that everything with them is temporary. Even if they say peace, well, peace to them could be for 10 years or 15 years. Problem comes when they break their agreements, which they will in any thing. What happens? Do we take back any land or settlements or whatever? What happens in that situation? That's my question.
Look, on one level I don't have an answer for you, because I recognise that the Palestinians are not, you know, purer than the driven snow and so on and so forth. And part of my answer actually resides, maybe paradoxically for you, in the strength of the Israeli army and the forces to, if a situation arises. By the way, just let me go back a second in answering you, and that is, even if Gaza hasn't succeeded as it could have, should have, we hoped it would, many Israelis, most Israelis, including the architects of the Gaza withdrawal, would argue that the situation has improved for Israel as opposed to the status quo. It's far from perfect, but far more Israelis were being killed in that area and dying altogether pre-Gaza withdrawal than post-Gaza withdrawal. And as bad as all the bombings have been, and they're intolerable, and Israel's entitled to respond, they don't pose an existential threat to Israel. And by the way, looking at the broader context, what does pose an existential threat to Israel in real terms is, of course, as we know, the build-up in Iran that Jeffrey spoke to, and not only don't I minimise it for a second, I'm absolutely terrified by it, but one needs to understand that if Israel is to in any way successfully meet that threat, either militarily or by international public sanctions, we cannot ignore the world's support and dealing with the rest of the world on certain terms. And whether we like it or not, it is clearly the demand, the interest of the world community, including those that are very supportive of Israel, that there be the creation of two states and that Israel engage in certain give and take. And I think they need to do so in order to secure and accommodate those things that really do pose an existential threat to Israel. So look, I'm not the military kind of person that if the situation arises, and I think we're not there yet, there can be land swaps, but I would suggest to you that as generals, leading politicians, Ehud Barak, you name it, Rabin, all of them, I mean, these guys were not complete idiots. I think they have a pretty good understanding, Sharon and others, of Israel's military prowess and strength. And I think there's a general consensus that at the moment, anyway, that can be dealt with if it needs to be dealt with should a circumstance arise for territorial swaps. I can't outline how and when. But I can say to you that they equally understand that without the rest of the world at least offering some form of support, we're really losing in the area of security where things really count. I mean, I read on Haaretz today, for example, that Iran has threatened to knock out the US missile defence system in Turkey. Now, we have problems with Turkey as well. We have problems with Egypt. But at the end of the day, there's still a cold peace, even with Egypt. And it's been critically important for Israel's security over the years. And I expect it'll be so going forward, unless there's a cock-up along the front. And if there is, heaven forbid, the Israeli army still has the capacity, and by having the support of the US, for example, that is the best way of securing Israel. I just can't think of any other alternative, Michael. You know, that's, I guess, I don't know if it's an adequate response, but I'm trying to be as, in some ways I'm hawkish, okay, believe it or not.
They can't take back the land, that's what I want.
Okay, but the land is not everything that secures Israel.
Johnny,
Jeffrey, what about him?
I can ask Jeffrey this question that he can answer, but Johnny, I think it's unhelpful to use the word potential for apartheid state. It's unhelpful to use the word racist. All our enemies use that. We shouldn't be using it. That's the first point. Second point is, you're on the AJAC editorial board. You know about it, our Rumbung Fellowship, where we send opinion makers to Israel. How many of them come back and go to the cities, in, for example, Gush Etzion, which is in Judea, and come back and say they're regular citizens, they're not settlers? You speak about a few people on outposts who create problems for Israel. It's the first thing. Second point is, Bob Hawke, who's considered a friend of Israel, spoke on Boyer lectures a number of years ago, and he gave Israel this advice, and it seems like you're giving Israel the advice also. Give up the territories, and then if you're attacked again, you can take them back. This is about Israel's survival. We've got missiles. You've spoken about Iran. We speak about Hezbollah. How many missiles have Hezbollah got? 40,000? Maybe more. So, you know, it is Israel's survival.
So should Israel not have left Lebanon?
It's survival. Final point I make is recognition of Israel as a Jewish state. Let's start from that. Let Abbas say he recognises Israel as a Jewish state. That's one of the criteria you want to use, and you say Israel should be a Jewish state. So I just make
okay.
that point.
There are 4 points you raise. I'm sorry, Jeffrey, if I've been asked a question. It's probably the nature of the audience here, but it's not my fault. I was obviously more provocative in the negative. I'll go the last point you make because my mind's going. Look, you know, it would be wonderful for the Palestinians to recognise Israel as a Jewish state, and I think it's important that the Israeli Arabs recognise Israel as a Jewish state also. But at the end of the day, to me, it's a little bit of an add-on, a little bit of a red herring, a little bit of an added card in the poker game of negotiations. But fundamentally, it's not for the Palestinians, the Arabs, the Americans, or anyone else to determine what kind of state Israel should be. It's for the people living in Israel and for the Jews, and hopefully for the Jews all over the world, to ensure that Israel is a Jewish state. It's not a question of them defining us, just as it's not for us to define whether or not Egypt should be a stronger Muslim state and there should be the Muslim Brotherhood. I hope there's not, or it should be an Islamic this or that. The definition of Israel will be contained in the way Israel operates, and God knows there's going to be a hell of an internal struggle there in the future, as there is right now, about what the definition of a Jewish state and what its meaning is. As long as Israel can function as a Jewish state, then it will be a Jewish state, with or without the recognition of outside forces. And my fear is, though, that, and I'll come back to your first point now, because I remember it, that if it doesn't shed itself of the burden of occupying another people who will eventually overtake us in numbers, then I will not resile from using the term, and I'm using it very carefully. There are those who say that Israel is an apartheid state in the making. I don't believe that either of those is the case, and I will rebut that notion as forcefully as I can. But at the same time, I will put to you that if Israel were to have a majority of non-Jews in its state and not accord them equal rights and claim we are a Jewish state, therefore we are allowed to not give them equal rights, then I would put to you that that would be an act of apartheid. And if you've got a better word for it, please provide it. But heaven forbid that we should ever arrive at that situation. Then as far as Ajak goes, yeah, sure, there are some scholars who make the comments, but look at what you read day in and day out and see coming out of Israel, and it's not just the way Palestinians on the West Bank are treated. I'm actually more... I read Haaretz very happily. And by the way, I met with the former editor of Haaretz on the weekend and was very happy to do so, and he's really not the devil incarnate, let me tell everyone here. But I'll tell you something else. My bigger concern, Jeffrey, my bigger concern is that it's not just the way in which the Palestinians on the West Bank are. Slowly from within, there's becoming an attitude and a culture of creating second-class citizens amongst the Israeli Arabs themselves. And there's creeping legislation of late, which is just one indicator of that. Why on earth, for example, would you eliminate Arabic as an official language of Israel when it's always been the case? It was declared in the Declaration of Independence. 20% plus of the population is Arabic, and all of a sudden unilaterally you want to remove that? Is that not an act of insensitivity or provocation? Isn't there an increasing view and perception that the Arab population in Israel, which has always coexisted to a reasonable extent, is slowly, slowly becoming a fifth column? I mean, ultimately, we might prefer that they not be there. I know Jeffrey's come up with one of his wonderful ideas, which is essentially a transfer idea of that population as part of a swap.
Absolute nonsense.
Well, I've read that in some of your articles.
No,
but
you have not read that. I take gross offence.
I apologise if it hasn't been said.
They do not leave where they're prisoners.
No, they just become part of... They become part of a Palestinian state.
But if you're going to start playing the
Take it back. Okay, I'll get back to the main point, and that is that there's becoming a mentality in legislation, in attitude of anti-democratic behaviour. I think it's being fuelled to a large extent by Lieberman, the foreign minister, who has to a degree got the Israeli government by the Beitzim, and I think has brought certain habits from his country of origin into the discourse of Israeli political behaviour, and I think that's particularly unfortunate. And I think it's also an area in which Jews in the diaspora, because it doesn't relate directly to security and defence, should be speaking out, because these little creepy forms of legislation towards anti-democratic outcomes are something that should concern us all. I hope I've answered all four elements of your question. I think Israel's the most fantastic place in the world, but I want to see it remain that way, Michael, okay? You know, I've got as much attachment to Israel and as much love for Israel, I would say, as just about anyone in this room, except there's only one guy that I can see here who, if he gets up, I'll shut up, and that's David Metzler, because he lives there. The rest of us should have a little bit of humility when having these kind of discussions. Hey?
Including for David Landau.
Including for David Landau, of course.
Is he the one that said that Israel should be raped?
Okay, can we get off the David Landau thing, please?
By the way, David lives in occupied territory.
Alon, let's try and keep the question short and the answer short.
By the way, but he lives in a part of the occupied territory which, by any conception, including my own, including anyone who's sane, and I think from what I've read, Abbas understood this full well, would be part of the swap, although there could be randomly someone in this room who, unfortunately, would not live in that situation, and just as people in Gaza had to leave, it would be that certain settlements will be given up also. I mean, that's part of the reality. It won't be pleasant. It'll be ugly. But I think most Israelis would accept it in the right circumstances.
You're all welcome to visit anytime.
I'm
going to do something a bit refreshing. Firstly, I'm actually going to phrase a question rather than a statement. And secondly, I'm actually going to limit it to the topic in discussion. So, which is the 1967 borders? Because, Johnny, you said earlier that both the majority of Palestinians and Israelis favour a return to some sort of arrangement along the lines of the 1967 borders, and it sounds like Jeffrey as well is in support of a two-state solution, unless I misunderstood. Now, what my question is, if there is a significant Jewish population within what was formerly Palestinian territory within the 1967 borders, do you see them existing as a Jewish minority within a Palestinian state? Do you see them being moved? Do you see them? I mean, we spoke about the disaster that was the removal of Jews from Gaza, and regardless of what you ethically, how you ethically view it, it was logistically an absolute nightmare, and the majority of the people who were moved in the Hitnat Gut are still suffering the consequences. So what do we do with the hundreds of thousands of Jews that now need...
My answer to you is, often ikroni, in principle, there's no reason why any part of anywhere should be Judenrein, just as there are non-Jews living in Israel. That's a matter of principle.
It's just the territories.
Yeah, in the territories. But I would imagine, and I could be wrong, that the overwhelming majority of those settlers who are living in settlements that are deep inside the Palestinian territory and in any conceivable land swap would remain in a Palestinian state, I would find it pretty inconceivable or unlikely that they would wish to remain there, although some of them would because somehow there's a messianic attachment to certain areas. In principle, they should be able to stay. Now, the negotiated outcome might be otherwise, and I'm not here to preclude or to say that, but from my perspective, if you like, from an ethical ideal point of view, they want to live there, why not? You know, just as if Jews wanted to remain in Arab lands, they would have been Meshiga after 48, but why not? And some did. But, you know, in reality, I think that's extremely unlikely, But I'm not here to draw the borders. I know nothing about that. That's not my game, you know. I'm just talking about 67 being, not because it makes sense, not because it's ideal. It's just the reality we have to deal with, guys. There's no other game in town if there's going to be a two-state solution other than modified 67 borders.
So we only have time for one more. You had your hand up for a long time.
It's a follow-up from the previous question. Gitei 67 is not relevant, but I'm not taking a political side of the fence here. I think we've got to accept that a two-state solution will happen. The question is, it seems to have been derailed to an extent, or it seems to be being driven outside of Israel by saying the 67 borders must be the the framework for a two-state solution, and otherwise the Palestinians are not going to accept an Israeli such counter. So I think it seems to me to be far, while it is arbitrary, it seems to be far more important in the political debate that's going on, so we kind of need to address that, don't we?
Look, I'm saying it is what it is, you know. I mean, what are we going to do? Go back to draw, you know, square one and recreate a two-state solution based on if it was creatio ex nihilo and there was no one there and we had two peoples over two lands. Ideally, this is the way we do it. I mean, for better or for worse, between 48 and not only 67 to this very day, there's a demographic reality, and that demographic reality is that Palestinians who lived there, who were driven out of there, etc., etc., happened to be the overwhelming majority in one part of the land, and Jews happened to be the overwhelming majority in that part of the land. You know, they're not going to love each other, but I think a nice divorce, a quick cut, is the way it's going to happen. That's the way the international community sees it. That's the way the Israelis see it. That's the way the Palestinians see it. To get up and to say it's irrelevant or that shouldn't be the basis for negotiating if you're really talking about a two-state solution, I think it's pretty fanciful, you know, if you really want an outcome.
On the table before, it was never on the table at Oslo. It was never raised on the table by any American presidents.
What?
He suggested the 67 border as the...
Well, it was raised by Clinton. It was raised at Oslo. They were talking territories all the way through pre-Oslo. I don't know that there's been any other thing. I mean, the whole Clinton thing that was nearly clinched, according to Barak and others, the whole Olmert-Abbas thing, all of those were predicated on some modified form of 67.
This modified.
But I said modified. No, hang on. Let me clarify again. I'm not here to advocate the exact outcome, but 67 is relevant to the point that it would be the basis for modification, and most people are saying, well, here's the amount of land on each side pre-67. We'll do an equivalent land swap, incorporating at least where most Jews are into Israel and offering an equivalent amount of land to the Palestinians in the final outcome. To pretend that those borders are irrelevant, though, they're still fundamental to determining a land swap. Anyway... Geoffrey, I wish there were questions for you, and I apologise for having misquoted you on something.
Yeah, I'll just make, for those that want to check, and Mandy will...
I apologise.
Mandy is a, I think, an editor of Gullis. Is that right? No, you're not. The statement I made, if you go onto the Gullis Australis website, if you Google in the... Not Google, if you search on my name, you'll see the articles that I've written. One does address a fairly novel way forward, which I disclaim at the outset as being presently unworkable. And in it does make the statement that population transfer is beyond Israel's moral compass. So you can understand why I reacted the way I did when it was represented.
You did
that
suggest
I said
that Jews in diaspora should have an equal vote, which... sorry, mate.
That's not population transfer.
Yeah.
So for those of you that want to look at it and critical comment, that's fine.
We don't have time for any more questions.
I know you said one more, but I want to leave this one hanging, please. The proposition that Johnny made, that somehow or another Israel can affect a negotiated solution, is the one proposition he did not deal with. Now, you talk about almost clinched, nearly there, kind of, sort of, almost made it. And on every single occasion, it was the Palestinians who said no. What makes you think they're going to say yes if Israel makes yet another offer?
Okay. We'll have to give you the last word, Sam, which is what you... Jeff wants the last
word. There was one other comment that I didn't mean to say at the outset before question time began, and that was the charge of racism. For those of you that actually do look up the Gallus website, part of the, and it's been mentioned now, the question of giving the vote to Jews externally, part of the paradigm also was to make all West Bank Palestinian Arabs Israeli citizens and giving them the vote as well. And if that's racist, well, I guess I'll have to plead guilty. But the most friendly act any country can do is to give people citizenship. So it may be out of left field. It's there for debate, but racism, no.
Thank you very much again to our speakers. JBD, for your information, runs events like this one, provides information, resources and various other things. Whoa. Please go to jbd.org.au and sign up. And we've got Tolent on Friday. Thanks very much.